tonight on Arena. New movies including Sentimental Values, Saipan and Avatar 3, and it's the 50th anniversary of Pink Floyd's Wish You Were Here. You're very welcome along to what I thought for most of the day was Friday night's Arena. I've been acting on the mistaken assumption that today is Friday. It is only Thursday. 51551 on text. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. You can email arena at rte.ie. And as always, we are on Instagram at rte_arena. Now, you might be looking to leave the house over the next couple of weeks. Maybe slink off on your own for a little while. Maybe the dog has had enough walks. And probably the very best thing to do, if the dog has already been walked, is escape and go to the cinema. That's our roundabout way of saying there's a lot of films for us to look at this week. I'm going to be joined by Ruth Barton and Paul Whittington, who've been to the pictures for us. And in our first review, we'll be talking about A Dog Called Triggs, and we'll all be feeling triggered. Much as we love to spend the rest of the evening playing Put 'Em Under Pressure, we're going to start you off tonight with a film which tells a uniquely Irish story, because most of you will remember where you were as the events on a small island called Saipan unfolded. It was 2002. It was the lead up to the World Cup in Japan and South Korea, and the Irish football team were getting ready ahead of the games ahead. Saipan is a new film starring Steve Coogan as Mick McCarthy and Aina Hardwick as Roy Keane. Paul and Ruth, you've seen the film, but I'm also joined by RTE Sports' Eamon Horan, who not only has seen the film, but who was reporting on it at the time. Can I first say you don't look old enough to have been reporting on
No,
it
I was a cub reporter, Rick, in fairness.
Neither here nor there.
Only out of school.
Only out of school, absolutely.
Eamon, when you heard that this film was in the works, what did you think of it and what did you think of the casting?
I thought the casting was really good. Hardwick was fantastic. He brought a raw intensity, very much like Roy Keane was back then. Steve Coogan, Alan Partridge for Mick McCarthy, that was a little bit strange. I thought he was slightly clumsy as the depiction of Mick McCarthy. I know he's a gruff Northern England lad and so on like that, but I thought he was a little bit clumsy. He lacked nuance. That's what I'd say about Steve Coogan for Mick McCarthy.
It would have been very easy, I think, for both of these portrayals to have become caricature, because we've seen so many people do a Roy. I mean, even Roy is doing himself in television ads these days. But it doesn't go down that road.
No, it doesn't at all. And it's very, you used the word at the top of the programme, it's very triggering. It doesn't go down that road. It's like a Greek drama. It is intense. It builds up to what we know is a huge row at the end. I enjoyed it. And it wasn't a caricature. It was like a stage play. But it was good and it was evocative.
What was it like watching events that you yourself had reported on at the time?
Well, I tell you, it's funny. No social media back then, per se. So there was no Instagram, no X. So Tony O'Donoghue, my esteemed colleague, our esteemed colleague, features very prominently in the movie, as we know. And you look at how the news reports, the TV news reports, the radio reports, the newspapers, that was how we got the news. And it was almost being drip-fed out that there was this huge row on this Pacific island. And it was fascinating to see that's how we got the news. We were literally waiting for every news bulletin for an update.
Paul, on the off chance that people don't know this story, there are people listening to the show tonight. I hope we have an audience that's young enough to not know about this story. So tell us, remind us of the story again.
Well, it's so painful, isn't it, to remember.
But it's too soon.
It's too soon, 20 years later. But so basically, Roy Keane, as people will know, he's on the telly all the time now. He's a wonderful pundit, a very funny man. He was one of the best midfielders in the world in the early 2000s, captain Manchester United. And he, by the skin, we had a decent side then, I'd have to say, but by the it was him who dragged us through our group, which included Holland and Portugal. We beat Holland at home. I was at that game. I'm sure you were at that game too. You were probably at that game too.
I was at that game, yeah.
And everybody noticed the
it was
pain.
Everyone at that game.
Everyone was at that. It's like the GPO.
It's like the Munster game, years ago.
And everybody noticed the pained half handshake at the end of that, and that was trouble brewing. The FAI, some genius in the FAI, came up with the idea of some R&R in Saipan before the World Cup proper in Japan, South Korea, and they thought it'd be a bit of a laugh. Roy thought that they should be training. There were no footballs, bad pitch. We were saying to Eamon, he was from the future, Roy Keane. He thought that you should prepare for tournaments and so forth, and it just wasn't up to scratch, and the storm broke.
My head is spinning here ever so slightly to have a sports person reviewing films and a film person talking about sport in here.
I wasn't there.
You're the one. Ruth, there's really interesting questions in this, not only the question of preparation and about how Roy, the way he's portrayed in this film, is pretty much the way all footballers act these days. They all expect that level of professionalism, but also the question of what it means to be second generation Irish as well.
Yeah, I really like that bit, that exploration, because one of the things in that infamous showdown that Roy Keane throws at Mick McCarthy is, you're not properly Irish. And Mick McCarthy is outraged because he says, yes, I am. And there was this whole thing, I remember at the time, about the plastic paddies, and the plastic paddies were all the people who played or the English B team, you know. They were all the people who played in England who maybe had an Irish grandparent.
Who maybe had a granny or maybe didn't. Like,
yeah,
Tony,
and some of them didn't. If you were adopted, that one went a bit wrong, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But there's a lot of really interesting stuff that's very much of its time about what you have to do to be Irish. And what you have to do to be Irish is to be born here and have an Irish accent, except if you weren't and you're saying you're Irish. And so I think we've moved on from that moment, but it captures that moment very nicely about the kind of refusal of a certain kind of element of the population to recognise people as being Irish, even though they felt Irish and were entitled to be Irish.
I want to take something from the film. So this is en route to Saipan on the plane, mid-air, after quite a hectic airport departure. Roy has some concerns to share with the manager. It's Aina Hardwick as Roy Keane and Steve Coogan as Mick McCarthy.
When I was a young footballer, they were training us to be athletes. Now we're athletes, they're training athletes to be footballers. Do you know what I mean? You know, the game's changed.
Oh, undoubtedly.
And we need to be prepared. It's not you having a stopover in Saipan if it's going to have a bad effect with lads.
Why would it have a bad effect?
Well, we travelled in for over a day for a start. I mean, that airport nonsense was chaos. There's no need for that, Mick.
Humility is important, Roy. When I was captain, Big Jack would always tell me...
Right, Big Jack. Big Jack was an English fellow who liked to pat Irish lads in the head.
Eamon, sports films are very hard to do and hard to do well. Is this done well? And why do you think?
I think it's done well. As I said, it's very triggering. It brings you back. You remember the granular details about the team going on the banana boat and this poor quality of food in the hotel. That all came back to me.
I'd forgotten about the banana boat.
The banana boat, yeah. And I'd forgotten about the BBC interview in the airport.
Yeah,
which, when you think of it, it would not happen now player of Roy Keane's stature would be by himself in an international airport, with surrounded by the media, and that interview. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think that interview went on for about 20 minutes.
Yeah.
With Stevie Watson.
He couldn't get away from him. Yeah.
And he was by himself. Think about that now. Just Roy Keane by himself in an airport being interviewed by the BBC with no handlers flying home. But that said, I thought it was good. I enjoyed it. As we said, it opened up a lot of debates about plastic paddies and preparations and what have you. But it was doing well.
In terms of the use of real footage in it as well, you know, frequently you can see films like this whereby for various reasons they have to kind of recreate either news stories or they have to recreate. But in this, it's just layered upon layered upon layered with real TV footage, real radio footage. Mm-hmm. There's the voice of, like, Anya Lawler is in it, the voice of Jerry Ryan.
Tony O'Donoghue, who was in it a lot.
And Tony is in it a lot. All of Tony's stuff is in it a lot, particularly that one moment where he's on, referring to himself as being on a camera phone from Saipan.
But that's the way it was, Rick. That was it. It was like you'd wait for the news bulletins to get an update from Saipan. There was no social media. So nobody knew what was happening until you tuned into the 6-1 or got the 9 o'clock news or listened to radio bulletins. That's what the way it was. And particularly when he came home, when Roy Keane came back to his house in Manchester, frenzied speculation that he was about to get a government jet back to Saipan, that one of the, some business tycoon was about to provide a jet to bring him
back. Everybody went mad.
And everyone went mad. Yeah. And there's these rumours were swirling around. So it dominated the airwaves. And it was just... It was very much of its time, and I thought the movie did a good job evoking that.
Okay, I want to get another moment from it. This is when they've arrived in Saipan, Mick unwinding in the steam room, and Roy arrives and he has some more grievances to air.
If this is day one, what chance have we got?
You're a bit overdressed.
I've seen the pitch, Mick.
Okay. So far, it's not great, but, you know, they'll do for what we need.
Why, since when have we needed a rockery? I mean, seriously, you're asking lads to risk injuring themselves in it. Why? I should have spoke up during the meeting.
It's day one, Roy. Relax.
We don't have the kits, we don't have the drinks, we don't have the sun cream, we don't have footballs.
We're just doing drills. We can manage without that stuff.
Without footballs?
It'd be better if we had footballs.
I saw Hamnet the day before this, and then I saw Saipan, and I'm still not sure which film I found more traumatising. Ina Hardwick, he's having quite some time at the moment. This week on Arena, we reviewed the production of the Playboy, The Western World at the National in London that he's currently in. The filmmakers don't make it easy for him here. There's plenty of archive footage of the real Roy in and around it as well.
Yeah.
Somehow, though, he disappears into the role, doesn't he?
He does, absolutely. And I think we were saying earlier, it's very difficult to play Roy. Everybody knows him. Like, he's a huge figure in Ireland and over in the UK as well. So he has to kind of forget that on one level and not on another. And what he gets is the essence of Roy as he was then, this very intense, driven person with very high standards who playing for his country really, really matters for him, almost more than anybody else, it seems. But also that sense of humour is there, that wry humour. I think that the film, it approaches it as a Greek tragedy. People will go, there were no footballs. That was true for a couple of days. That's the way it was approached. So there's no football in the film, really, and nor should there be, because there was no football in Saipan. So it's very much this very enclosed, claustrophobic drama, this was a situation in which nobody won and everybody had regrets coming out of it. And you see that. And it builds to this extraordinary climax where he's cornered by Mick and the rest of them. I think it plays out very well as a drama.
There's a big what if as well from a sporting context because it was a relatively poor World Cup.
We were talking about
right?
that.
Yeah. So conceivably, had Roy Keane, who was at the peak of his power, stayed, could Ireland have won the World Cup? We never know.
This is what I mean by traumatic. There's almost that moment because you're watching a drama here where you think, what if Roy goes back?
Yeah.
What
yeah.
if?
Yeah.
I'm
is he going to stay?
Yeah, you know how it's going to end. And then you think, no, it can't.
It can't possibly end that way.
Yeah.
But Ruth, talk to me about Steve Coogan as Mick McCarthy. He, I mean, almost arguably has the harder job here.
I think he does. I mean, he is Alan Partridge.
There are moments of Partridge.
Yeah, it's very Partridge-y. I think, because he's kind of the boring foil to Roy Keane's energy. And you know, it's set up quite nicely because he's got the kind of boring suburban house and Roy has a kind of pretty nice place. And you can see already there's an achievement difference between the two of them, which is expressed through the way that their houses are kitted out. And he's got this kind of, Mick McCarthy, so it's Alan Partridge, whoever you want, Steve Coogan, has this kind of nice, ordinary wife and they're worrying about what they should paint they should be getting to do the fences. And he's just this sort of regular guy. And I think he does a good job because, I mean, everybody knows who he is, right? He's very recognisable too. But for me, he does a good job of just representing a people pleaser. You know, he wants everybody to be happy. He wants the thing to work. He can take compromise and he's up against somebody who doesn't compromise. And he just wants the team to get along with it. And you can see that he's really hurt by the personal attacks on him. And yet his job is to get this team to play in the World Cup. And if his star doesn't play, and everybody's got a different side on this one, you know, if his star doesn't play, he's still got to get the team to the World
I'm
Cup.
I'm intrigued is the producers get poetic license, but did that phone call at the end happen from the hotel room?
The, Well, I think what they said, and they said to you probably the other day, is that it's a drama. They did loads of research, and some of the big scenes, they kind of happened, though not in that way and not in that order. So I think they'd probably say to you, it's a drama.
At the end.
Maybe, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
I think the thing about it is that if whatever prejudices you go into and we still cling on to them, you'll come out of it with them. It's fair in that way. Like I would have been very anti-treaty, that is to say pro-Roy, and still am, whereas somebody else will go to, like my dad, Lord Reston, would have been very, we were saying earlier, very law and order. So people were having rows in their houses about
There's
it.
There's a generational divide about it, really.
There is, and I don't think you'll change. It'll change
pubs
your mind.
Were, you know, pubs were bristling with the two sides.
I think one of the crucial things about the film as well is that if you're going into it cold, it doesn't attempt to push your hand in either direction.
No, it plays it completely straight
and allows you to make up your own mind as to who side you're for.
And you can see both sides.
Ruth, talk to me about the idea of this film and whether or not it'll do any business outside of Ireland. Will we be the only ones who care?
It's hard to see it, really. I mean, I know that Roy Keane has a personality. You know, he's a TV personality, and he's on, you know, advertisements, and he turns up on Late Late Toy Show, but that's here. I don't really see an audience outside of Ireland being as engaged, because they don't have the emotional engagement that everybody...
There'll be some football curiosity, I think, in the UK.
And the Man United crowd will sort of remember him. And then, of course, we do have Steve Coogan, who maybe will carry it a bit slightly outside of Ireland. Mm. But I think, you know, in fair play, this is an Irish film for an Irish audience. We don't get that many of them, and I think that's great.
Okay, give me some stars.
I gave it 4 out of 5.
Okay,
Paul. Same for me. I enjoyed it overall. It was satisfying. 4 stars. Yeah,
and Damon.
Likewise. Four out of five. I thought it was really good.
Four from all of
you. And it's very interesting. Sorry, I brought my 17-year-old daughter to the press screening, right? And it completed the jigsaw for her as to who Roy Keane was.
Oh yeah.
That he's not just the guy in the toy show. He's not the guy in the Sky ads. That he divided a nation, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So it solved the jigsaw for her.
Eamon Horan from RT Sport, thank you very much for coming around. Sadly, you're not going to hang on to review the new Avatar film.
But why not?
You might as well.
Might as well.
We will definitely be doing
Blue
that
people.
After these. Just to remind you as well, we spoke to directors Lisa Barros-Dessau and Glenn Leyburn and screenwriter Paul Fraser earlier in the week here on Arena. You can listen back to that in the usual places. Now, back to what we laughingly call Normality Thursday Evening Arena. Next up, it's another sports biopic, this time about a young American table tennis player, the eponymously titled Marty Supreme, starring Timothée Chalamet as Marty. The film has even enticed wellness guru and Oscar winner Gwyneth Paltrow back to the big screen after 6 years away. Paul, the inspiration for this film is a true life story. Tell us a little bit more about that.
It is, and it made me wonder again, we're talking about, you know, dramatised fiction. I mean, how much did they depart? Marty fella, he did write a biography in the 70s, and this film comes from the director,
Josh Safdie's,
his interest in table tennis. Says apparently table tennis is a big thing with Lower East Side New York Jewish people, and I don't know why it is, but it is. And he played it growing up, and he became interested, and then he heard about this guy, and he read the book. And really, if Martin Scorsese and John McEnroe had joined forces to make a film about table tennis, this is what it would be like. This guy's life was chaotic. It's the early 1950s. He's a mover and shaker. He's working in his uncle's shoe shop, but he hates it. He's always grifting and hustling at table tennis, which I didn't know you could do, but he does. And he's always trying to get money, and he wants to go to London to the World Championships and win it. And to listen to him talk and brag, you think he's going to do it.
Okay, let's take a moment from it. This is a scene from Marty Supreme. Timothée Chalamet as Marty. He wants to change the way people see table tennis, literally.
This is a normal IATT approved ball.
Try to follow the white ball against the white. Almost impossible, right? I don't even see your eyes moving.
If I'm wearing a white shirt and I'm wearing this, you can't see the ball. Now imagine it with an orange ball, which no one's ever thought of. See, you're already following it way better. Look at his eyes. See how his eyes are looking?
Yeah, you're looking more engaged now.
A custom ball like that is going to cost a lot of money.
Of course, it's custom. It's an original ball for an original guy. It's a Marty Supremo, not the Marty normal ball.
So, Ruth, Marty is this underdog who has skill, courage, ambition to make it big. Do we want him to go all the way? Are we behind him?
Yeah. Hello. We first of all have to recognise Timothée Chalamet is playing Marty. This this turns the whole film around, because if it had been a Martin Scorsese film, you'd have had, you know, you'd have had maybe Leonardo DiCaprio. But because you've got Timothée Chalamet, he brings all that Chalamet stuff with him. And he's, you know, he's been outrageously promoting the film. He wears orange because it's a thing about the Orange Ball. And it's also Timothée Chalamet's, you know, personality coming through, because, I mean, he's only 29, for goodness sake, and he's got all this stuff about his good looks and about his ambition and about his outrageousness and about the stunts he pulls, and all of this goes into his character as Marty. And he's been disguised a bit. He's got some acne scars on his beautiful face, and
he's thinner than usual.
He's quite skinny, yeah. And he wears these sort of rather geeky glasses, and he's got a brill creamed hair,
yep.
and sort of baggy trousers.
Oh, they put geeky glasses on him. That makes all the difference.
Well, yeah. actually, now
looking he's not
at you,
good looking
looking
at all.
At you, Rick, but so you can't take Timothée Chalamet out of this film. And then you've also got to think, oh, it's a Safdie film, and the Safdie brothers have been making films together for a long time. And, you know, a lot of people will have seen Uncut Gems, which was their really great film when they were working together. And so, and they make these films about the Lower East Side and about Jewish life and about grifters, and they're also hyperkinetic films, as this film is. And they also like to bring in non-professional actors. And one of the joys of this film is the people who are cast in it, because Abel Ferrara,
who people
will remember.
He's kind of good in it too.
He's really good in it. He's this thug whose German Shepherd gets kidnapped.
Responsible for films like
Bad Lieutenant.
He is a director of films that people may or may not have seen.
Yes.
Yeah, King. I mean, he also made a lot of sort of low budget exploitation films as well, and he's great in it. So the Safdie brothers, it's this real mix between a Timothée Chalamet film, it's Josh Safdie without his brother, in fact. Timothée Chalamet film, a Safdie film, and then this true life film about this table tennis player, and everybody keeps calling it ping pong to his fury. It's table tennis.
Yeah.
And I think the whole thing comes together in this kind of crazed movie, which I really enjoyed.
Comparisons are going to be drawn, Paul, because this is the second Safdie brother film this year. Both of them are about real life stories. Both of them are about sports.
Yeah. I have to say, at the end of this film, I was going, that was mad.
Yeah, mad.
But I liked it. I preferred it. And I also think that the frenetic energy that Ruth is talking about, it's the rhythm of table tennis, especially with, not the way we would play it, you know, ping, ping, but the way these people play it. And I think that the total commitment of Timothée Chalamet in the film, like it's high risk, actually, as a performance. And his range staggers me, because, like, he played Willy Wonka, you know, 2 years ago, and he's you said at the start, do we want him to succeed? No, we do not, because he's a tick. He is not a pleasant person. Beware all females in his vicinity. I actually thought that Gwyneth Paltrow was actually good as
this faded
movie star. This she had retired, and she's married to this obnoxious sadist of a millionaire who we wish ill on more than Marty. But he begins this affair with her in London, and simultaneously, we should say, his childhood sweetheart, who is also married to somebody else, is pregnant with his kid. So he's got it all going on. Spoilers, he doesn't do too well in London, but there's a rematch. And you're propelled through the film by this energy. And visually, it's very interesting too.
Yeah, and the soundtrack as well.
The soundtrack was clever, because what they did with the soundtrack, that's absolutely right. Marty, again, like Roy a bit, is from the future. Like, he is the spiritual father of all the obnoxious sports stars to come of the 70s and 80s, and he really goes for it. And so they use 80s techno tunes rather than 1950s music. And I think that's really, really clever, because it's telling you this is a person who's going forward all the time.
So, Ruth, overall, for people who might have seen film about table tennis, that might not be for me. You think they should make the effort?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are some great table tennis sequences in it. And it's also shot by Darius Conji, who's one of the great cinematographers.
Yeah, it's beautifully
done. He shot Seven, and and the table tennis scenes are amazing, because the you know, just the movement of the ball and the movement of the players is incredible. But it's, yeah, absolutely, you know, as Paul's saying, it's about so much more.
It's not really about table tennis, and the table tennis bookends it in a very interesting way, but it's so well done. And the best bathtub scene in a film, 2025.
Brilliant bathtub scene. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
is the
about a dog enabled.
People will just have to go and see it. Okay, if people, do you think it's going to do much for table tennis, Ruth?
Or even ping pong? No, I'm
might
not.
Might put some people off. Maybe
I'm not certain you'd actually sign up for it or sign your child up for it. Certainly after this.
Okay, give me some stars, please.
I gave it 4.5.
Okay, Paul.
Yeah, probably give it 5. Actually, yes, very, very.
I
good.
Thought the ending was a little bit sentimental. It just slightly.
I kind of liked. You know did why? You, yeah. We're not giving. We're, don't worry. No spoilers.
No spoilers. No.
Please.
But there is a rounding up of his character and a sort of proof that he's maybe capable of anything other than just going forward in one direction. I look quite like the ending.
Yeah,
so
I
thought it was
it.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to move on to the blockiest of 2025's blockbusters, Avatar 3, Fire and Ash. Its director is James Cameron, who used to be remembered as the director of Titanic, Aliens and T2 Judgment Day, but for the last 16 years has pretty much only lived in the Avatar universe. Ruth, catch us up as to where we are in the story here, maybe for people who haven't seen it before, or for people like me who watched the first one and then completely forgot to see the second one.
I'm with you on that, because I saw the first one, didn't love it, although so many people loved it that it became the highest grossing film of all time, so that puts me in my corner. But I didn't see two because I hadn't loved one. And actually, if you haven't seen two, it starts you into action where you are doing a little bit of catching up, because this film is so long, it doesn't have time to do and what happened before, you know, it.
Sort of doesn't matter what happened before, though.
Oh, you couldn't care less. But I mean, just
I saw
say.
Two because I had to. But it's sort of, you can sort of join in pretty quick, I would think.
Oh, you can really catch up. It's this is a father-son story, basically. So we're on Pandora, which is this magical kingdom that the human population wants to exploit. So it's whenever in the future. Human population wants to exploit it. Living in Edenic bliss the family, Jake Sully, who used to be a human but is now a Na'vi member, they're the tribe, and his wife Neytiri, who's pure Na'vi, she's played by Zoe Saldana. They're grieving the loss of their eldest son, Netayam, who died in 2, but we didn't see that, and their younger son, Loak, played by Britton Dalton, is suffering from guilt because of his brother's death. They also have some other members of the family. There's Kiri, who's their adopted daughter, played by Sigourney Weaver. I mean, played by, I say, it's, you know, voiced by, and the characters have been, whatever, green-screened. She's adoptive, but she's probably really the daughter of the Earth Mother. This is important.
Or is it?
Or, well, actually, is anything that I say at this moment important? They also have their human foster son, Spider, played by Jack Campion, who has to always wear an oxygen mask because he can't breathe the air in Pandora. But, well, I won't say what happens to that story. His birth father is Colonel Miles Quaritch, who is a human who has died in a previous occasion and has now been sort of reconstructed as a blue Na'vi person.
Yeah.
And they're going to have sort of father and son moments throughout the film. Are we getting there? And then there's
I'm
a lot.
I'm not sure.
And then there's a whole group of really nasty, bad tribes people called the Ash people, who are led by the sort of vicious Queen Varang.
Una Chaplin, she's good.
Una Chaplin, she's very good, yeah. And she gets the best part, because actually being the baddie in this is probably much more fun than being the good guy. So she's, you know, launching assaults on poor old Pandora, and the humans are still trying to capture Pandora to exploit for their horrible ends. And there's a lot of fighting.
Let's take something from it to see if all of this makes any sense for us. This is Sam Worthington and Zoe Saldana in Avatar 3 as Jake Sully and Neytiri.
Look, I'm a Marine. Not taking a knife to a gunfight. Or a prayer. So what am I supposed to do? I can't run. I can't fight. That's right. Awa will provide. Yeah? So where was Awa? Where was Awa when our son...
Jake! I'm in this place where I have nothing. Not my people. Not my forest. Even my father's bow is gone. All I have is my faith. This is the Great Mother's plan.
You have this family.
Paul, are we in two camps here of people who understand Avatar and people who don't?
Very much so. They're people who absolutely love this, and you can see from their point of view that it's like a virtual world and it was ahead of its time in that sense, and they just can lose themselves in it. And actually there was a 2 minute sort of little teaser film before it in which James Cameron, it showed actually the value of it in the sense that the actors really do act, and you can see the performances in this more than you could in the first one that you remember, and they employ thousands of people. They're going to bring people back to the cinema. So in theory, the arrival of Fire and Ash should be a good thing, but then you have to watch it. So for me, it's just it's 3.5 hours, and it's yeah, you're sort of worn down and sort of seasick by the end of it.
And in 3D as well.
Yeah, the 3D is not
a 3D thing for me.
If people are going to it, I would say don't go and just look at it normally, because I don't think he's clinging on to this. I don't know how much it brings to it really. And some of the animation, whatever, the sea is brilliant. The underwater stuff is very good. Like, it's not without merit technically.
Mm. He's also very anti AI and
absolutely
anti-special effects.
And he says that.
Everybody here is all about motion capture, about actual actors in actual suits. It's really important.
Yeah, so in theory, I am cheering for this film.
How many stars are you giving it?
Probably the 2.5.
Truth.
I gave it 2 for the world building. I think he should have used AI for the screenplay. It might have been better.
Ouch.
Ooh.
Tumbleweed rolls across the arena studio. Last night we heard from Stellan Skarsgård and Joachim Trier about their new film Sentimental Value. It is a family psychodrama about an emotionally remote film director and the fallout his adult daughters have to deal with. The film is certainly awardsy. It won the Grand Prix at this year's Cannes Film Festival, and it's up for 8 Golden Globes, including Best Picture and Supporting Actor for Stellan Skarsgård. Ruth, who is Gustav Borg and why would we not want him to be our daddy?
Yeah, he's not the most caring of parents, is he? He's this narcissistic film director. So this is a film about filmmaking, which is always very gratifying if you're a cineast. And he is just what you'd expect for a film director who's come to the end of his career. He's got one movie left in him, which people doubt is going to be good. So in fact, it turns out he's written this brilliant script. But in order to write this brilliant script, he's mined his own family story. So he is the father from hell who leaves the family. It's set in Norway. It's Norwegian film. He leaves the family, he goes off to Sweden to follow his career, and he leaves them all behind in the home, which is the house that much of this film takes place in. And it's also sort of emblematic of the family's dysfunction, because there is a literal crack in this house. And so he leaves behind his wife and his daughters, and then he goes off to pursue his very successful career. Cut to the present, he's got this one last screenplay which he's trying to get made, and he's going to find it very difficult to get funding. And the way to do it is to be reconciled with his daughter, who is a very successful actor, particularly stage actor. He tries to persuade her to do it, and she's having nothing of it because she despises him.
And this is Renata Reinsve's
who is
character.
Nora, yeah.
I want to take a scene from it. This is Stellan Skarsgård as Gustav Borg, Elle Fanning as Rachel Kemp, who's the actor who is going to star as his daughter in the film, and Inga Ibsdottir as his daughter, Agnes.
Rachel, this is my daughter, Agnes.
Hi, Rachel.
Nice to meet you.
Are you in the business as well?
Oh, no.
No, she helps me with research sometimes.
Yeah, I'm an academic historian. Yes. Sorry,
Do you recognize her? She played Anna in the film you saw.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
Of course. That's... You're Anna. That's right.
I see it.
Can I take a selfie with you?
Yeah, sure.
Starstruck.
Paul, there are digs at the archetype of the European auteur cinema maker.
Yeah.
I mean, Skarsgård, he's quite knowing in his portrayal here. I mean, he does know one or two of them, in fairness.
He does. I think we're sort of in high Bergman country here, aren't we, really? And I mean that in a good way. There are references to Bergman films, but to be able to reference Bergman films well is sign of a good film. And I think it's a wonderful film. It's a deeply, deeply, profoundly European film. And Stellan Skarsgård does an interesting thing, because his character initially is obnoxious, and the daughters are horrified when he turns up to the mother's funeral in his Sunday best when he hasn't been around for years. And he is a solipsist, as Ruth said, but he's also very charming. And he's not a sociopath or anything at all. He's capable of more. And we then find out the story because the other daughter, Agnes, is a historian, and she finds out about his mother. And her, she was in the resistance during the war, and she was tortured and so forth. And that darkness was transferred to him. So he's been on the run from that ever since, and on the run from everything. So there, and all of that is done in a non, sort of in a rolling way. It's not obvious, and I think that the dynamic between the two daughters, and particularly between Nora and him, is fascinating.
Ruth, these conversations inevitably happen at this time of the year. There's a little Oscar buzz around, possibly around Stellan, because he's been nominated for a Golden Globe as well. He's had a great year. His role as Luthen in Andor, I thought he was great in that as well.
Yeah, he was.
Do you think he could be in the frame for an Oscar here?
Oh yeah, very much so. I think so, and I think the film should be in the frame for an Oscar itself.
It will be for the international Oscar. Yeah,
international, yeah. Because it is, you know, as Paul's saying, it's a really complex film, but it doesn't tell you what you should be thinking. It's offering you all these
very funny
themes.
Sometimes too.
Some great. Yeah, there's a very good joke about an IKEA stool.
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
And there's a lovely interaction right at the very beginning between Nora and Jakob, who's her sort of intermittent lover, and she's got stage fright, and everybody's racing to the door because she's supposed to, it's for theatre, right? She's supposed
That's
to be going
great
on
opening.
Stage.
Yeah.
It's the opening, pretty much openings. She's supposed to be going on stage. She's got stage fright. She's locked herself in her dressing room. Everybody's going crazy. She suddenly comes tearing out. She rushes off to Jakob, who's working on the production, and she says, "Either we have sex or you slap me." And so he takes the slap me option and slaps her. And then she's grand off. She goes and does clearly a brilliant performance in what is some sort of avant-garde theatre production. So these are very funny moments, isn't it?
Okay, give me some stars for this, please, Ruth.
Oh, this is a full-on five for me. I loved it.
Same here, yeah.
Yep. Five from both of you. And that is our final film this week, Sentimental Value. My thanks to Paul Whittington and Ruth Barton, and indeed a little bit earlier, Eamon Horan. Avatar Fire and Ash will be in cinemas this weekend. Sentimental Value and Marty Supreme will be in cinemas from December 26th, and there'll be previews of Saipan from December 26th as well. It'll then go on general release in cinemas on Thursday, January 1st. You're listening to Thursday Night's Arena. The Pink Floyd album Wish You Were Here turns 50 this month, and to mark the occasion, the band has released a new box set with previously unreleased alternate versions, song demos and live tracks. There are 30 tracks based on an album that originally had 5. Songs like the title track and Shine On You Crazy Diamond reveal a band still mourning the departure of Syd Barrett, the musical genius and co-founder of the band, who'd left in 1968. Pat Carty has been listening to tracks old and new for us on this. He joins me now in studio. Pat, 1970s Pink Floyd was a very different animal to 1960s Pink Floyd. So talk to me first a little bit about what the lineup was by 1975.
Well, I just wanted
where they were as a band as well at that stage.
I want to take you up on something there. Musical genius, Syd Barrett. Yeah, that wouldn't be my...
You're not impressed with
that
Syd
wouldn't
Barrett?
Be my opinion. That's
interesting
Syd Barrett
to start this item.
Yeah, you know, here's my bike, you can ride it if you like, and Piper at the Gates of Dawn and all that stuff. No, not for me, a musical genius, but that's okay, that's all right. Sorry, Pink Floyd fans who are out there listening in. Yeah, they were a very different band. Syd had mental problems, let's call a spade, and that wasn't helped by the amount of acid he put into himself. And eventually the band kind of had enough of him. There's a story about them going to a gig, and one of them says to Roger Waters, "Listen, will we go and pick up Syd?" And it was Waters, apparently, who said, "Ah, let's not bother." And then I think a couple of months later, he kind of agreed, whether under duress or not, to leave. And then there was several albums then as they kind of changed. David Gilmour had come in. He was a school time friend of the lads, and he'd come in, and they were a 5-piece for a short while because he was there kind of covering for Syd, you know what I mean, on the guitar. And then they progressed through albums trying to find an identity, really, until they got to about 1973. And there's a huge quantum leap, I think, from what they did before to Dark Side of the Moon. And everybody, and we were just talking about it just before the light went on, we both have copies of Dark Side of the Moon at home, and I'm sure loads of people listening have it, sold something like 50 million copies. It's still the third best-selling album of all time, but it's a strange one because it's about alienation and mental struggles. I have written down here, Thriller It Isn't. So they were a very different band, and this was, I suppose, the hardest thing for a band like this is dealing with success. If you sell 50 million copies, which they didn't straight away, but you know what I mean, what do you do next? So they went into the studio in January 1975, and what witnesses say is there was an awful lot of time spent falling asleep on couches, playing darts. There was an air rifle that was in use as well, and there's a lot of drinking going on. And they had three songs from the tour beforehand, and this will show that the kind of theme was still going. One was called Raven and Drooling. One was called You've Got to Be Crazy. So you can see a kind of a pattern here. And the other one was Shine on Your Crazy Diamond. And as you mentioned, the box said Raven and Drooling and You've Got to Be Crazy are included on that and will be adapted for Animals later. But they're not on this one.
I want to jump back ever so slightly. That idea of Dark Side of the Moon, which is this enormous, huge, global album that makes their name everywhere. And again, it's a huge leap for them in terms of themselves musically. The pressure after that, and this album is just 2 years after, it must have been extraordinary.
Well, I suppose there's pressure in to follow it up, and hence they're kind of dilly-dallying when they're in the studio. But also, I suppose, you get free rein if you do something like that. Do you know what I mean? So record company and in 70s budgets, as we'll see when it comes to the cover and things like that, are just ridiculous because these things really sold. Band wouldn't get away with that now. But so they were kind of let do whatever they want. And that's the strange thing about, I always thought about Dark Side of the Moon, is that so many people identified with it. But it's not a very comfortable listen. And this is the same. So you have, coming into Shine On Your Crazy Diamond, as you mentioned, Sid, they had this song, and it was Roger Waters' idea to Roger Waters being the main ideas man, I suppose, in Pink Floyd, to split it into two parts and make it the bookends of the album. So originally it was this 25-minute long instrumental thing, which is a bit like Echoes on Metal, which was one of the albums before that, and put it in the middle. But the lyrics are very much, whatever they might say, Roger says it's about himself a bit. But when you have stuff like, when you were young, you shone like the sun, seer of visions, you reach for the stars, it's about Sid. And then you have the episode when they're mixing it and Sid actually arrives into the studio.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to remind people, just in case they need reminding, of Shine On You Crazy Diamond. Let's have a little of that first.
Remember when you were young? You shone like the sun.
Talking about it, but I know some Pink Floyd fans will find it as heresy. My thought is always that Christy Moore's version of Shine On You Crazy Diamond is just as good.
Every day is a school day, Rick. I'd never heard of that before. Never.
It's worth the listen. So tell me about this. They're in the middle of doing the sessions. And what's the Sid story?
Yeah, Sid, apparently he was around at the offices of Storm Thorgerson, which is one of the designers from this Hypnosis design crowd who did all of Floyd's covers. But he was around there and he went looking for Storm and he wasn't there. And he said, he's around at Abbey Road with the band. So Sid turns up. Now, at this stage in 1975, Sid is very overweight. Not only has he shaved his hair off, but he's shaved his eyebrows off as well. You know, he obviously wasn't well, and he came in, and the lads in the band didn't recognise him. David Gilmour said he thought it was an employee in a bad way from Abbey Road. And I think David Gilmour was having his wedding reception at the time in the canteen of Abbey Road, which seems a bit odd, really, if you have all that money. You couldn't find a better venue for your wedding reception. Anyway, he comes in and he hung around. He came a few times. He hung around for a few days and people were crying in there when they realised who it was. And then, as Gilmour says, he just kind of drifted away. He wasn't really there at all anyway. And the band never saw him alive again. So I would presume that this really, you know, while they were on that road anyway of doing an album kind of about alienation and as is their want and you know, what's the best word, insanity, I suppose is the word that I'm looking for there. So that would have inspired it. And then, you know, you have the lyrics of this thing, which Waters would claim later on that he was, oh, I was kind of singing about myself as well, but it's obvious he wasn't. You know, he was. It really seems to be aimed at Sid.
Talk to me about this box set. It is the prosaically named Wish You Were Here 50.
Yeah. Does what it says in the tin, yeah.
It does. What does it reveal about the album, about Shine On, about how it develops as a song, about, and what about the live stuff that occurs near the end?
Yeah,
of the album?
Well, the live stuff is actually from before the album. So as I was saying, those two songs that didn't make it, that were part of the original kind of what have we got in the tank, you know, and both concern similar subject matters. But with Shine On You Crazy Diamond, you have, if people know the album, I think it starts off with Shine On You Crazy Diamond, part 1 to 6,
one to,
is that?
6 or 1 to 5. 1 to 5, yeah, whichever, yeah.
And then it's 7 to 8 or whatever it is, or 7 to 9. So if that's not punishment enough for you, what you can get on this album then is you can get the whole thing put together as 1 25-minute suite, I suppose. And there's another one where it's an instrumental version. And you get a couple of a kind of work versions of, say, things like Welcome to the Machine. Now, this would be my problem with the album. There's two songs. You've Shine On Your Crazy Diamond, first of all. And then it goes into a thing called Welcome to the Machine, which is it's a dirge, in my opinion. It's 7 minutes, which is about 7 minutes too long. It's Roger Waters going on about, you know, what did you dream? We told you what to dream. Well, it's strange, this millionaire telling us how bad life is. And it uses, as Floyd did, and they did on Dark Side of the Moon as well, you know, there's the use of synthesizers that people talk about being innovative. But Stevie Wonder was doing things with synthesizers at the time, and The Who were doing things, you know, and they... There's just a bit more soul to it, in my opinion.
Tell us what you really think, Pat.
Yeah, that's what I really... Well, no, I haven't got to have a cigar first. So side two in Old Money, we turn the record over and we get this Have a Cigar, which is, again, one of Roger Waters' Sticking Two Fingers Up at the Man songs, which he would do whole albums about later on. The Wall seems to be mostly about that. And it's kind of... It could be a follow-on to Money from Dark Side of the Moon, only not quite as good. And, you know, it has that famous line, which it's a prospective manager talking to the band. He says, "I love your band, by the way, which one is Pink?" And, you know, so, but if you can get through that, and it's actually sung, strange enough, there's a story there that's sung by, what's his name, Roy Harper, the kind of folk hero Roy Harper, who was in Studio 2 of Abbey Road at the time. Now, while I was typing this up yesterday, I have to drop this name here because this is just weird. My phone rang yesterday while I was typing this up. And it was BP Fallon on the phone. Now, this is a true story. Sorry for dropping his name.
And
he was ringing. We'd done some stuff this year and he was ringing to say Happy Christmas. It was very nice of him. How are you, BP, if you're listening? And he said, "What are you doing?" And I told him, he says, oh, he was working with Roy Harper at the time. So he was in the studio. And not only was Roy Harper there, the Shadows were in Studio 3, which was a big thrill for BP Fallon. And they all played cricket outside with Pink Floyd. So there you go. Anyway, that gets
that's
us through
that. Information
that
you're not going to find on the internet anywhere. Yeah. I want to play a little of Wish You Were Here from the album. This is the title track.
Lead roll in a cave.
Wish You Were Here from the original album. I listened through to all of this over the last couple of days. I was doing a lot of homework at home at the time. The thing you find really interesting about it for me anyway is there is a version of Wish You Were Here on this with Stefan Grappelli.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so just before we put that on, I was telling you about all the other people in Abbey Road, but they weren't the only people there. Stefan Grappelli, God, my teeth are falling out, and Yehudi Menuhin were both working on a record in one of the other studios. Yeah. And they were both invited to play on it. And Menuhin, is that how you pronounce it? He turned it down, and Grappelli said yeah. And they came to an agreement about for £300. As a session fee, which in 1975 is a fair whack of money. Mm-hmm. And he played on it. And as you say, it's on the box set. It's not bad, you know, but you can kind of see, I think you can see why they made the decision not to use it. And there was, in Floyd legend, you know, some people say it was deleted, but other people say his part was turned down. And that if you listen very carefully to the original version of Wish You Were Here, you can hear it. And then the other story is then, because it was so inaudible, Roger Waters thought it might be, and I'm using inverted commas here on the radio, insulting to credit him on the album sleeve. But Roger Waters famously didn't want to credit anybody for anything. So it is interesting to hear it because it kind of adds this kind of, I suppose, a kind of country folky kind of vibe to it.
It's interesting.
Yeah,
it's interesting. It's less jazzy Stefan Grappelli and more, I want people to have listened to
it. I'm not sure
to
replace it in people's affections.
No. So what we've done is we've taken the song and the original song plays and Stefan Grappelli appears about 3 minutes into it or so. So have a listen to this here. And then there's a little bit more of Stefan Grappelli a little bit later on in the track. These box sets, Pat, can be, depending on bands, depending on the time, depending on what's available, either treasure troves, and I'm thinking of a few of the Bob Dylan bootleg sets that have come out over the years, and sometimes they can be what's left that we could make a box set out of. Where does this fall in between those two? Do you think?
I think for fans, you know, I mean, it might come as a shock to some people listening. I'm not a huge fan of Pink Floyd. I don't know if that came through in the last 15, 20 minutes. But as you say, it was interesting to hear it. I think with a lot of these box sets, you know, those Dylan ones are exceptional and the Springsteen ones are exceptional because they're all new material. With a lot of these box sets, you're kind of, it's extra takes and things like that. And they're interesting to hear once. I'm not sure if you go back to them too much. I mean, and let's remember, this isn't the first Wish You Were Here box set. There was one in 2011. And I have to tell the story about the designer. He was being interviewed by Mark Blake, who's written several books about Pink Floyd. And included in the 2011 box was a pouch with three marbles in it. And Blake says to the designer, he says, "What's that about? What are they there for?" And he says, "Well, if anybody's mad enough to spend this much money on a box set, they've obviously lost our marbles. So here we are returning them to you." So that'll say something about it. I think if you're a Pink Floyd fan and somebody gave you a present of this on Christmas Day, wouldn't you be delighted?
But not necessarily the sort of thing you want to have on Christmas Day.
Well, give us the gift receipt as well.
Pat Carty, thanks for joining us tonight. Wish You Were Here 50 is out now. And that is it for tonight's Arena. Amongst other things, tomorrow night on Arena, we'll be taking a look at all of the Christmas TV that you should be looking forward to over the course of Christmas 2025. And we'll be reviewing the new Amadeus TV series and the new series of Emily in Paris as well. Tomorrow night. That is it for Arena, produced by Sheila O'Callaghan tonight. Our researcher was Paula Shields. Mary Elizabeth Bruton is the show's broadcast coordinator. Harry Bookless on sound supervision. And I'm Rick O'Shea, and we will talk to you again tomorrow night here on RTE Radio 1. If you want to listen back to any of the programmes or any of the items on it, you'll find them on our page on the RTE Radio 1 website. You'll also find them anywhere you can find your own podcasts on the RTE Radio app. John Creedon is next, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.